You're on RN. You're listening to Counterpoint. Hi, I'm Amanda Vanstone. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that in the 19th century, the largest exporter of ice, as in the frozen water sense, the largest exporter of ice in the world was the United States? And did you know it was sold as far away as India? Americans loved frozen water and in 1880 were themselves using 200 pounds a year of ice per capita. From this love came the icebox, or what we now know as the refrigerator. Today we're going to celebrate this humble kitchen appliance's birthday by talking about its evolution as a vital but modest piece of technology. According to the 2014 Index of Economic Freedom, Australia rates third behind Hong Kong and Singapore. New Zealand is ranked at 5, Canada at 6, and Denmark rounds out the top 10. All of the countries in the top 10 are considered to be economically free. They're also peaceful. I add that because a new study has found that higher levels of economic freedom can help reduce the risk of violent conflict. That if peace is more profitable than war, guess what? Peace wins. It all comes down to the pursuit of self-interest, and we'll find out more about that very soon. But it's time to talk now about matters arising in Australia with Counterpoint regular David Birchall. Well, over my time in government and my time in opposition, it was nearly always the case that whoever was in government was cross with the ABC for one reason or another. And then, of course, my lot, as I call them, people to the right of centre, although in my case not too far right, perhaps always have a few beefs with the ABC. But they're not the only ones. Everyone in politics seems to at some point always be unhappy with political coverage. Now, is there increasing politicisation of the media or not? So to talk about that, we welcome back to the program David Birchall. David, welcome back.
Thanks, Amanda.
Now, what is going on here? Is our media becoming more politicised?
I think if you did a straw poll out there amongst our listenership, the answer would be yes. I think the question is sort of how and why. If some of our listeners grew up, say, in Western Europe, in Britain or another Western European country, it's long-standing tradition there for the print media to be political. You have a history of newspapers attaching themselves to political parties or causes. You know, the London Guardian, which used to be the Manchester Guardian, has been associated first with the Liberal Party and then with the Labour Party for well over a century, I think.
Yep.
The Times has usually been conservative for its entire life, pretty much. And likewise across Western and Southern Europe too. I mean, political parties have actually had mass newspapers. The Italian Communist Party, when it was a major party of opposition, actually had a major daily newspaper, believe it or not. It sounds bizarre, but it was true. An extraordinarily dull one, but they had one. But we've never had that tradition in this country, and I think until quite recently, the assumption has been that both the print media and the electronic media stood above the fray to a significant extent. And there were always a few people who were understood to be more partisan than others, but they were usually exceptional cases. And even on the ABC, for instance, where you had players, significant people commenting at the ABC who'd previously been in politics, often as advisers or private secretaries, they often went at great lengths to avoid the impression of being partisan. I think that's all changed over the last 5 to 10 years, and now the media in Australia, particularly the print media, but also the electronic media as well, has become much more openly partisan. And I'm not just talking about talk radio, which of course is the great exception to the rule I just gave, that's always been partisan, but I mean, as it were, serious political coverage has become more partisan. I don't think there's one simple explanation for that. I think it's a whole cluster, but I do think it's a very obvious and striking phenomenon. I mean, not just limited to us, it's been true in the United States as well, where traditionally newspapers, well, there were exceptions, but newspapers were rarely seen as closely tied to political parties, at least not until maybe the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, I get comments from people about the print media that they're finding it harder and harder to find simple news, a story on a policy change that is just about the policy change. That many people are fed up with too much commentary, media types telling them what they ought to think or giving them their version of what they think, rather than a story that simply says, this is what happened today in Canberra on a particular issue. And when there's so much comment, people say, well, where do we get the facts from? Do you hear that?
Oh, yes. No, I think that's one of the most striking phenomena of our era. I mean, people have talked about it for a while, but I don't think it's become enough of a matter of conversation or argument in the media itself. There are various possible reasons, of course. One is simply the rise of the internet and then social media, which prioritizes comment over analysis and opinion over expertise. I think that's the other issue here. Increasingly, political coverage is dominated by people who are disseminating their own opinions rather than providing anyone else with the benefit of inside information or expertise. And so you get opinion authors in newspapers, and, you know, both of us have done this gig. You are doing it. And
I
thought we both know the temptations to do that. But you do have to have something solid behind what you're talking about and to have some knowledge of the situation that goes beyond that of the next person in the pub. And I think increasingly comment is opinion, and opinion is increasingly simply the venting of strong emotions by people who use language well and are often aggressive and self-confident, but don't seem to have a great deal of inside knowledge, let alone sort of factual information about what they're talking about.
Yeah. So why do you say that electronic media favours opinion over substance?
I don't think it has just been a matter of the electronic media. I think it's been both, and I think it's more striking in some ways in the print media. I mean, in a sense, the electronic media has always kind of been a good place for people to rave.
Mm-hmm.
It lends itself to that. I think radio in particular, people just listen to it in their car, and they like a good rave, and they don't take it too seriously. But I think the problem has been that, I think you're absolutely right, that the lines between reporting, expert commentary, and general opinion have become very blurred, even in media which previously didn't behave that way. And I think one of the most striking things there is that it's not just, as it were, at the lowbrow end of the spectrum, that increasingly it's been happening at the highbrow end of the spectrum too, and that people seem to take having strong views about current events, world and Australian, as being a license for saying anything they like, even in a reasonably supposedly serious highbrow forum. I mean, I think it's a fine institution, a new institution, but even Q&A on ABC television, I think, has now got into that space, or always was in the space, of prioritising opinion and personality as the primary determinants of a good argument, rather than the quality of the information and the analysis being brought to bear, to be frank.
Yeah. Well, come to my notional couple, Bob and Mary Stringbag. I've always felt that they feel left out of what I call the great conversation of life, that's politics, because you have experts telling the story about what their expert opinion is, and then you have commentators like you and I and others filling the pages, and I just think Bob and Mary think no one gives a damn what they think.
Yeah, there's clearly the danger that it becomes an internal conversation. I mean, everyone likes to talk about groupthink, but of course groupthink is one of those things that other people do. It's not something that any of us ever does ourselves. But one of the obvious things I think about the media becoming increasingly partisan and polemical is that it solidifies groupthink. I mean, to be frank, let's be frank about this, there has been an undeclared war between parts of the ABC and parts of News Limited for probably since the last half dozen years. And I think that's not all bad, that there are different parts of the media and that they have strong points of view. I mean, it can provide a good argument at times, and people need political argument.
Many would say that's a good thing.
Yeah, no, that's right. And there can be sometimes something phony about people pretending not to have a point of view when there's clearly one hidden behind what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's better just to come out with it. But nevertheless, at the same time, I think that when media commentary becomes partisan and much of it is directed towards, as it were, the other side, I mean, let's be frank, the Australian newspaper spends a lot of its time attacking its media enemies, and people at the ABC and in the Fairfax media do the same. And I fear, at its worst, it simply becomes a license for bad behaviour. You attack your enemies from a position of righteousness, and you start doing exactly the things you accuse them of doing, only slightly worse. And it drags the level of conversation or argument continually downwards, I think. You know, I think I've made this point before, possibly wearisomely, But theorists in the humanities in recent years have tended to focus upon the sort of mimetic quality of political argument, how we have this curious tendency to want to ape our enemies and copy them, and the more we argue with them and fight with them, the more we'll come to resemble each other. And I think that's been very striking about the polemicization of the media, that, as people have said, increasingly, are my opponent in the other corner there is telling lies, so they seem to feel increasingly inclined to play free and loose themselves while they're doing that. And I think the quality of the coverage is often not enhanced. And I should say that, having said what I said a minute ago, I think is still true. Political argument is not necessarily a bad thing, of course, in the media.
It's a good thing.
Yeah, it's good to have things being debated openly, and it can be good to have heat where it's generating light as well. But if it's simply an excuse for lowering one's normal standards of behaviour and one's relationship to the facts, then it's not a good thing.
No. If we go back again to the couple, Bob and Mary, who are left out of this debate, I think they might like to remind our commentators and experts and everyone else that comes in to chip in and block out the views of Bob and Mary and their neighbours. And it's this, that you can get the best experts in the world and you can get the best elected officials and the best bureaucrats, but they won't necessarily come up with the right answer. And the way to explain that is to look at shoes, surprisingly shoes. You can get the best shoemakers. They might be from South America. They might be from somewhere else. You can get the best shoe designers. Probably not much argument there in Italy. And
no,
you can
I
get the best...
Could be an argument. It could be somewhere in Northampton in England, but that's a long story.
It could be. You can get the best shoe leathers, and I might say, well, they'll be kangaroo or something like that. So you can get all these, you know, best of everything to put together into a shoe. But only the wearer can tell you where it pinches. Only the person who puts the shoe on can tell you where it pinches. And that's why the views of Bob and Mary, as ill-informed as some people might think they are vitally important. Because they decide whether they like the shoe of government of the day or not. And if you believe in the democratic system and you don't believe in a government run by experts ignoring public opinion, then you have to take public opinion into account. And you have to inform public opinion, that is, cast light, as you say, not just heat. And I'm not sure we're doing that at the moment.
I think you're right. I think there's several different elements to that. I think one of them is obviously treating the public with respect. I think one of the worst things about an over-politicised media debate is that the listeners and the viewers get treated with disrespect. Columnists and newspapers or commentators on radio who are forever telling people what to think clearly presume that people can't think for themselves. I mean, some of the commentary that I heard about the situation in Gaza was so ill-informed, but at the same time so strident, it gave the impression that some of the commentators didn't think that anyone else in the country had even heard of Gaza. And I would have thought that actually a good many Australians knew just as much what was happening there as some of the commentators. And so there is a disrespect, I think, towards the public that comes out of an excessively opinionated media commentary, because the media seems to be arrogating to themselves some exclusive right to pass judgment. And actually, you know, we're all capable of passing judgment. What we don't all have is the sufficient information to inform ourselves about what's going on. And that traditionally was thought to be one of the key roles of the media, the information first and then the argument afterwards. It doesn't work so when you do it the other way around, I think.
I did a piece for The Age recently on why we shouldn't just keep trashing politicians, that we should have some respect for our institutions. And if you want to read the swill that passes for blogs underneath, you'd see people saying...
The comments, the dreaded comments, yes.
Well, a lot of them are. I mean, there are some informed comments, but others you think they haven't even read the article. But
Don't feed the trolls, they say.
Yes, a constant feedback was, well, you know, you don't get respect until you earn it. I understand that. That's fair enough. But my point is that the Australian public in various seats elect these people. That's their choice. And when you decide to trash a politician, unless they've done something wrong, I mean, that goes without saying, they should be dealt with. But you're trashing the choice the Australian people have made. That's where the respect comes from. Not respect personally, but, you know, this person has been chosen by my fellow Australians to be a representative, and I have to show my fellow Australians the respect they deserve by listening to what this person says. That's not unreasonable, is it?
No, I don't think it's unreasonable at all.
I just feel, you know, poor old Bob and Mary or the Australian public at large are being treated by many as though they're ill-informed and what they choose doesn't count. As if, well, for example, when a Conservative government is elected, or a Liberal government, as I would say, many people say, well, the people made a mistake. Poor idiots, you know, they didn't mean to do this. They didn't mean to elect these people. Well, they did.
Yes, they didn't know what they were doing. Or on the other hand, if they did know what they were doing, they were just a malicious bunch of fools. Yeah. I think another paradox of the politicised media is that the more that one gets caught up in an internal argument between media personalities, the less easy it is to listen to what the public's saying. I've had a few experiences recently. I won't go into details, but one of them includes this August network, or the television arm of it, at least, where you had a journalist doing ostensibly a vox pop with the public, with selected members of the public trying to understand what they thought. But when you watched the vox pop in action, it seemed as if the journalist was simply hearing what they wanted to hear and not actually listening very clearly to what was being said at all. And you wonder then what the relationship is between the media and the people they're talking to when they claim to be trying to seek the points of view of their listeners and viewers. I think it's been a long-standing problem in the media. I think partly just because journalists and others live in that kind of hyperactive world where everything moves very fast and you have to be on top of a new issue every day, there's a tendency not to be able to stop and listen. And I think that's true not just of each other, but also of the viewers and listeners.
Well, I think the bottom line out of all of this is perhaps, you know, too much opinion. Bob and Mary being shut out, and what that really means is the Australian public, or the public at large in any democratic system, being shut out, not being listened to. That should be a warning sign to all of us. If you're in favour of democracy and you think something of the demos, you should be listening.
Absolutely.
David, thanks for joining us, and we'll talk again on this subject.
Take care, Amanda.
David Burchell is a senior lecturer in the School of Humanities and Communication Arts at the University of Western Sydney. You're on RN. You're listening to Counterpoint with me, Amanda Vanstone. Why do some countries experience civil wars and others not? Is it to do with political systems, perhaps ethnic or religious tensions? Perhaps a more important question is what needs to be put in place so civil war doesn't come about in the first place. Different people have got different ideas about what we should do to have a more peaceful world, to have peace in the sense of nations not at war, but also civil peace in communities. And recently, some research has been done that says, well, actually, believe it or not, free markets, that's the way to do it. There's an article written by Indra D'Souza and a colleague, and Indra joins us now. Indra, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, free markets and civil peace, who would have thought it? Not me, I have to say. But it's a very interesting topic. How is it that we've come to this, concluding that free markets have a role in setting the scene for civil peace?
Yes, I mean, this is a very thorny and complex question. But let's suppose that we have a policymaker who is debating whether he should have more free markets, let's say in a post-conflict environment. Should I have more free market policies or less of them? And our research shows very clearly that if you want to avoid things like armed violence, including very violent political dissent that requires, let's say, a political repression, and if you want ethnic peace, all of these done in sort of large data technical analyses, what we find very simply is if you were to place your money on a bet, then the better bet would be to have more free market policies. And the theoretical reasons for why that is true are many, and it comes down from the time of Adam Smith and the debates that has spurned since then, including Marx's critique.
So why is it that freer markets? What are the sorts of things that you find associated with freer markets that bring us round to that?
So the first answer is a kind of a social capital effect. When people are meaningfully connected in economic activity, for example, a group of merchants would naturally have a high premium on peace because violence would simply be bad for business. In the same way that a group of merchants in a neighborhood will organize to cauterize petty theft or crime so that their businesses are able to do business without disruption. So that's a very simple argument. In a macro sense, it's a hard thing to maintain because we do know that criminals do exist and do break into houses, and we need large police forces to police these things. And we know that they can't guarantee a crime-free environment 100% of the time. So that's a very large, broad argument that people acting in self-interest will bring about a strong element of cooperation in self-interest, will bring about social harmony and so on. So they will overcome collective action problems. Now, I hate to use jargon from social science, but collective action is simply that most people engaged in a collective endeavor like bringing peace, and peace is a public good, that is, you can't exclude people from peace. I cannot pay my share for peace, but simply enjoy it because other people have spent a lot or borne all the costs of bringing about peace. So in those situations, you'll have a lot of people who will free ride on peaceful situations, even try to capitalize on non-peaceful situations for own individual gain. So when we think about market economies, we think about people coming together in a community. That is, there is build-up of social capital among, say, merchants, among consumers, and so on to bring about peace. Or even neighborhoods, because we know that violence will be dangerous. But somebody has to bear that cost, and that cost can be borne by people who are engaged in meaningful economic activity, so collective action problems can be overcome. That's a kind of a very macro perspective. The micro perspective we've laid out in our papers come from a lot of research that have gone in trying to understand conflict in general. So one major understanding from that literature that is quite widely accepted now is that simple grievances among people don't lead to conflict, precisely because of those collective action problems that we have talked about. So, for example, in North Korea, where we would expect starving people to be out on the street and protesting their government's policies, that's not going to happen because the costs of doing so will be extremely high for those people who try it. And so people will simply free ride and wait for others to try to solve their collective dilemmas. But places like India, where there is a semblance of democracy and transparency of government and other things, you will have quite a bit of violence in neighborhoods, you'll have criminality, you will have also organized armed violence. Now, that is for reasons other than whether there are more capitalist policies or less, right? This is simply a question of state capacity. But so to get back to the question itself, we have come to understand that simple grievances alone do not make violence viable. That is, it's not feasible. Grievances alone don't simply make large-scale violence, which is costly to all. So violence comes from very narrowly based, opportunistic kind of reasons. Somebody's got to organize it. Somebody's got to profit from it, not necessarily in terms of big bank accounts, but let's say for revenge. Somebody may organize violence against a state for revenge, but that's a very private good. It's not widely shared or publicly supported. Or widely supported. So in those conditions, violence is very narrowly organized, and we need to understand those narrow bases of organizational advantages of some to make it unpleasant for the many. And this is where violence comes from. Guns, money, infrastructure, what we call in our paper rebellion-specific capital.
Yeah. Well, when there's a freer economy, is it correct to say there's less likely to be shadow economies, and it's that in the shadow economies where these people are more likely to be able to get their resources?
That is right. And in your broad, if you have a repressive economy, then what happens is simply a lot of profitable economic activity simply ends up in the shadows. The best example of this is bootlegging in the 1920s in the United States, which led to the big barons like Al Capone and others, who brought a lot of violence onto the streets of places like Chicago. And this is very similar, the same thing, in terms of a $200 billion drug economy, underground drug economy in the world, which is barely affected by all the resources that governments around the world try to.
Yeah. Is it the case that really the self-interest of having a business, getting some money, being able to look after your kids, and getting the opportunity to experience that brings about a common interest, because you all need peace to be there in order to prosper? It's not only that you don't want, you know, local hoods thieving from your business. You want mums and dads and kids to feel free to walk the streets and come and buy your things or your services. So operating free markets out in the open actually encourages a very wide group of people in their self-interest to promote the common interest.
Yes. And when I say free markets, some people might misunderstand and think, you know, just an open economy. That's not it. In fact, it's much more salient to talk about it as capitalism, as we know it, as classic liberalism would identify. And this is very strong property rights regime upheld by the rule of law, which is where people have proprietary rights, right?
Yeah.
So it's not just simply saying that I want my neighborhood clean, but there is a difference between whether you own the property in the neighborhood or whether you're simply renting from the man, right? And so we talk about property rights, we talk about less market intervention in the economy, because if there's more intervention by governments in the economy, that means there's less property rights floating around in terms of, let's say, the size of GDP of a state or the total wealth produced or so on. So what we are saying is markets that are the least likely to provide very high profits for shadow activity. So think about the Israeli policy of the embargo on the Gaza. The embargo is a kind of unnatural economic repression. Now, there are lots of governments in the world that have economic policies that actually act as embargoes, right?
Yeah.
So you're not allowed to open a business in this particular area because there's a monopoly for the general or the president's son or whatever, right? And so if you think of the embargo, about 99.9% of the tunnels between the Gaza and Egypt are built for simply bringing consumer goods into the Gaza. And because these tunnels are very profitable, it is just an open highway for all the people who would otherwise use it for purposes outside of economic activity to bring in arms and all those other things. So in reality, our advice to the Israeli government would be, don't expend your political capital by having to go into the Gaza every time rockets are fired or whatever. If you really want to close those tunnels, open the market into Egypt, because the legitimate business actors in the Gaza would get those tunnels closed, because now there is no high premium on bringing, let's say, a washing machine or a car, which actually come through those tunnels. So the price of a Hyundai in the Gaza is actually like the price of buying a Porsche in any other Western capital in Europe.
Mamma mia.
Yeah, so imagine what people can earn, because the cost of apparently maintaining a tunnel is something like $70,000 a month. But you can make $70,000 just by bringing one car in, right?
Yeah, and so you will.
Kind of like the drug trade in northern Mexico. You see, it is extremely profitable for people to organize violence and survive in the face of superior state forces. And that is what explains long-term drawn-out violence much better than does, let's say, a hunger riot where people simply raid a food store and go back home and that's it. But how do you explain a long drawn-out conflict in which a lot of people die, like the ones in the Congo, like the ones we witnessed in places like Sri Lanka many parts of Africa and so on, and the ones raging in India between the so-called Maoist rebels and the Indian state. So no amount of good governance or good laws, if they are only politically targeted, are likely to bring you peace benefits. But I am saying let's start looking far more at the organizational basis of violence, where violence becomes feasible and viable because it can be sustained by relevant revenue streams. That is, you know, not the 5 rupee profits, but the super profits that allow you to organize against superior state forces.
Yeah. Well, now, I just would like to ask something from your article that I understood the substance of what you wanted to say, but not how you got to this conclusion. It's right. Where you point out that in real-world terms, the magnitude of the effect of economic freedom on the risk of civil war is really strong. And you say that if everything else stays the same, raising economic freedom alone by what you call one standard deviation above its mean value will have, in the model you've produced, reduced the risk of civil war by 375%. Is that right?
That's correct.
That's tremendous.
Times. So, of course, nothing remains the same in the real world. A lot of these variables have an impact on each other.
Let me say there'll be lots of variables. It's a bit like pickup sticks. I understand that. But nonetheless, your study shows that if all the other things remain the same, and you go up one standard deviation point, and you and I don't even need to know what that means. What does one standard?
If you're an average guy, what happens if you go up to be a little bit less average? Right?
Yeah. So put all the details aside. If you lift economic freedom, it will have a dramatic effect on the risk of civil war. That's the shortest form we could put it in, isn't it?
That's correct.
Well, that's a good thing, you know.
And what we find impressive is that the effect of economic freedom is far greater than the impact of a similar change in per capita income. And of course, good policies are far easier to make that also affect your income possibilities. Good policies are far easier to make than getting wealthy, you see, because a lot of other factors matter. Yeah. So that's very good news for policymakers. You don't really have to wait till you get rich, but you can implement those policies that will also help you get rich, and in the meantime, not have to sacrifice the risk of conflict.
Well, Indra, I found this a very interesting article. A few bits were a little bit technical in terms of the data, but as we've discussed, you don't need to go to the detail of the data. You don't need to understand how the engine works. All you need to understand is what the conclusions in fact mean. Now, so I want to thank you for the article and thank you for joining us, but I did think I heard a chicken in the background during this interview.
Thank
Are
you
somewhere where I would be able to hear a chicken in the background?
No, it's probably a bird. I'm in Sri Lanka at the moment and we do have lots of lovely birds on the trees here. Much like Australia, the little bit I saw of Australia, you have the cockatoos, I believe.
Well, Indra, it's been very kind of you to join us. The line's been very clear. I think it's a great article, really worth policymakers focusing on this and recognising that it isn't a whole lot of laws you can pass that won't necessarily bring peace, and making people richer won't necessarily bring peace. But setting up the institutional arrangements for free markets just might make a contribution. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Via Skype, that was Indra De Soysa, and he's Professor of Political Science at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. And the report he co-authored is called Free Markets and Civil Peace, and it was published by the Fraser Institute. And yes, we'll put a link to it on our website. You're on RN, you're listening to Counterpoint with me, Amanda Vanstone. There's nothing quite like a birthday celebration, especially when it's for a 100th birthday. Now, I'm not sure if the Queen will send a celebratory message, but even if she doesn't, we can still open a bottle of champagne, ice cold from the fridge, and we can wish that refrigerator a very happy birthday. Well, you've heard people say, I'll get that from the icebox on very old movies. And if you're as old as me, you remember the Iceman coming around on a horse and cart. And you'd rush out and you'd get a block of ice and you could smash bits off and have it on hot days and it would be used to keep things cool. Refrigerators have made a tremendous difference in our lives. And we have joining us now a gentleman who knows a lot about it, and it's very happy birthday. Edward, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Now, what's the story with refrigerators?
The refrigerator as we know it was really born in 1914. The model that was introduced then in Chicago that late spring or summer was far from what we have now. It was really more of an add-on to a conventional icebox, but it was really the introduction of a new principle, bringing what had formerly been an industrial product into the home.
Well, it's pretty neat, really, isn't it? But I wonder if it's, in addition to all the good things it's done for us, has it done one bad thing? This is really a question for foodies, people interested in food. A lot of foodies tell us that we over-refrigerate everything. We put tomatoes in the refrigerator. Just about everything we can, we think we have to put it in the fridge quickly, otherwise it will, in inverted commas, go off. Whereas, in fact, people living before 1914 ate quite well, lived reasonably well, without dying of food poisoning because they lacked a refrigerator. Do you think it's made us all paranoid about food?
I think it's connected with a lot of things. For one thing, putting something in the refrigerator also is part of the sanitary thinking that was prevailing already in the early 20th century. You're protecting it from insects and so forth. And I know that where I live, I sometimes would find fruit flies if I left things out. So the refrigerator becomes a kind of security zone. And in fact, refrigerators are sometimes used for preserving sensitive personal documents. There have been little tubes where people could keep essential information. If emergency workers come and somebody is not conscious, in principle, they look in the refrigerator for them. So the refrigerator is a sort of all-purpose safe zone. And as you say, there may be some unfortunate consequences of that, but on the other hand, it's also a way to simplify people's lives because they need to shop less often. But of course, needing to shop less often, they also have fewer places to buy food, so they have to make longer trips, and they tend to load up their shopping carts with many days' worth of produce for which they need the oversized refrigerators. So the two reinforce each other.
Yeah. It's amazing to someone like me to reflect on the fact that ice used to be exported. Easy ballast, whack it in the ship and take it to another country where it wasn't so easy to make ice.
That was a great American industry at the time. And in Princeton, New Jersey, where I live, there was and still is a public park that used to be an ice harvesting field. And the area around Princeton, around rural New Jersey, had many specially constructed barns, which were seldom photographed because they were so ugly, or at least plain. But they were used to keep the ice until it was distributed or exported. And American ice had a worldwide reputation. We were the OPEC of ice for a while.
Good Lord, hard to imagine. Now, a lot of products follow a similar pattern in their development. They're developed for one reason and become useful for another. And as you mentioned, the refrigerator that we now take for granted in almost everybody's house was originally much more industrial and then developed as an adjunct to a home icebox and now the refrigerator. And in a similar way, mobile phones developed as something that was much more available to industry commercially, and then now just about everyone has one. So that in itself is an interesting pattern to recognise. But do you think we might go further and link our refrigerators to our phones?
One interesting thing about the refrigerator in the history of technology is the fact that the companies that brought the refrigerator into the home were not the makers of industrial refrigerators. They were a new group of entrepreneurs, some of them from the automotive industry,
mm-hmm.
who were used to producing objects on a different scale and marketing them differently.
Mm-hmm.
And in the essay, I compared that with the computer industry, where IBM, for example, only later followed the lead of startups like Apple in developing computers for the home, because their whole research and development effort, their sales force, everybody was geared toward the industrial client. So they were not the people who would see a great potential in the less powerful home scale equipment, but another group of people did, and ultimately in some cases the big manufacturers go into it too, just as our big telephone companies are also the providers of cell phone service.
Well, you mentioned that there's a company called Nest, which was bought by Google for $3.2 billion. That's amazing, $3.2 billion for a company that, as you describe it, has only two products, a thermostat and a smoke detector. What can you tell us about that development?
Many people now are talking about the smart house or the smarter house and the interconnection of everything in the house to the internet. This is still a speculative idea. I have newspaper clippings that discuss that going back to the 1990s, even the 1980s. In fact, I think that the origin of the concept may have predated the home computer as we know it into the 1970s. One reason for this is the success of the refrigerator. The refrigerator is not a terribly profitable item for most manufacturers because it is made all over the world. There is tremendous competition for the basic models. So the makers of appliances, understandably, want to upgrade and enhance and make more luxurious and smarter versions of their products so that they can improve their profit margins. And the smart house with the refrigerator that can be controlled from your smartphone might be controlled remotely, that is a very attractive prospect to them, and that's why the valuation of Nest was so high, that they are considered to be the company that has the technology to integrate home appliances most efficiently.
I'm a bit worried about that myself, if everything is linked up, and I know you can have a lot of things that you can do from your smartphone now in your house. But if someone gets control of your phone and you're not home, quite a lot of things can be messed up. For example, you'd lose everything in your freezer, for starters.
Well, a lot of people are concerned about it, and I think there's always an element of speculation in a sale like that. There is a defensive side to it. An established company now always is being reminded that there's somebody else who has a disruptive idea. They seem to be small now, but they're growing, and ultimately they're going to eat your lunch. So the idea behind paying so much money is that you are buying insurance against these people or somebody else merging with them or some third party sneaking up on you. And you can't really justify it by a projection of the profits that will come from that particular acquisition, but it's part of a mentality that sees disruptors everywhere and is determined to own all the intellectual property that could keep other people from infringing on your turf.
Well, let's go back to the refrigerator's sort of early days. In its early days, it wasn't entirely safe, was it?
No, the refrigerants used were potentially explosive, and that was a problem that many people tried to solve in different ways. In fact, Albert Einstein himself filed a patent with his colleague Leo Szilard for a new type of refrigerator, but it had a problem that it produced a high-pitched whine when it was turned on, so it couldn't, at least in its original form, be manufactured for the home. That shows how complicated research and development could be, that even Albert Einstein and Leo Szilard, two of the most brilliant minds of the 20th century, weren't able to predict all of the properties of a new mechanical chemical system.
You're right. Just reflecting on that, surely once they found that problem, they could find a solution. Or did they just give
up? Apparently they didn't, or the people who were licensing that, the German General Electric Company, didn't. This is, by the way, a very common thing in research and development. Very often you will find some kind of wonderful principle that is hailed in all of the science and technology magazines and is going to transform everything. What tends to happen, though, is that in the course of development, there is some kind of obstacle, and the company has to make a decision of whether to keep pouring money into it or to cut their losses. I'll give you some examples of companies that persevered. It took Procter & Gamble about 7 years to develop the first popular synthetic detergent, Tide, because the challenges were so great. The German company that developed it didn't think it could ever succeed and be practical. The Kevlar, which is used for armor and for many other purposes, took $500 million for DuPont to develop. The Xerox copier, about which I've also written an essay, took over 20 years to develop from the first patent because there were so many problems to be solved. For example, at one point, when a document had a lot of zeros and letter O's, the whole thing caught on fire. And they had to solve that problem. They had to reformulate the toner. So in many cases, there have been great ideas that might have been successful products, but that management did not judge, rightly or wrongly, to be capable of improvement to the point of being marketable. So there are people, by the way, now who are taking another look at that Einstein-Szilard patent, and they believe that maybe with some new technology that we have now, this principle can be revived.
So do you think many of the techno addicts will suddenly say, we have to get rid of our fridge because we want the Einstein fridge? Will it be marketed as the Einstein fridge?
That's an interesting point. I think that would probably be a strong marketing point if somebody could bring it to market. For early adopters, for people who want the latest high-tech goods, a lot of very rich people are in that technophile category. So they would be really very eager to have something with that pedigree in a way where they might not be so eager if this had been developed more recently. You see that, for example, with the marketing of the Tesla car, that Nikola Tesla, rather than Thomas Edison, now is the culture hero. And the Tesla car helps to sustain the Tesla legend, but the Tesla legend also helped to build the Tesla car. So the Einstein refrigerator could be the Tesla car of the household. And by the way, the threat to the ozone layer was really the result of a chemical developed, the chlorofluorocarbons, that was developed to be ultra-stable and thus not to explode. And the problem was that it was so stable that when it went into the atmosphere, it just stayed there, and it was a hazard to the ozone layer until it was finally banned, and now there are various substitutes. So
that's an example of solving one problem and creating another.
Yes, but it's also an example of how hard it is to predict the long-term consequences of any innovation. You can look at the immediate benefits, but then what happens when something builds up over time? For instance, when pesticides build up in the environment, when mercury builds up in the seas. I've argued in my book, Why Things Bite Back, that we have had a shift from the catastrophic problems that were more common in the 19th century, steamboats building up, blowing up, huge fires in theaters. That sort of thing that still happens, but it's less common now. And what we have more often now is sometimes as a result of our safety technology, we have long-term chronic problems. For example, asbestos was a miracle material that was supposed to stop these terrible theater fires and other problems. And it was supposed to provide better braking for railroad trains and save lives that way. But of course, the long-term effects of asbestos on health have really been terrible. And now everywhere you go in the United States, including the Princeton campus, you see still asbestos remediation, and everyone is spending billions of dollars removing what a century ago was the miracle material of the age.
Mm. You mentioned the fascination people have with new technology. I mean, I have friends, I imagine most people do, who as soon as the new iPhone comes out, they must have the new one. Even though there's not much difference between that and the old one, it won't actually change their lives in any material way, or even, one might argue, in any particularly in way of enjoyment. They must go and have the new thing. And I was interested to read in your article that you had dinner with someone, I must be a tech nerd, who was delighted with the concept of being able to have microchips on the milk so he could tell from his smartphone whether his milk was out of date.
Yes, this was in the day before smartphones, but he represented a certain kind of high-tech personality. He's a senior research person in one of the best-known American high-tech companies. And he represented a very nice person, by the way. I'm not saying this to criticize him, but he had this enthusiasm for everything having a potential solution in some new technology. So he could see that this would somehow make his family healthier and safer. And I can't say definitively that it wouldn't, but for me, managing this whole system would become so complicated that I would almost certainly want to do similar things the old way. But for him, it's really the opposite. It's a kind of enjoyable thing. It's almost a kind of game that he can play. These people believe that they can learn from it. It's not a criticism of them, but it's a very different mentality from that of others. And I would say in its defense that the early adopters benefit everybody by buying things before they are really terribly cost effective. And these people sustain products in the early stage of marketing, and they help bring the price down for everybody else. So we should all be grateful that people think like that.
Well, we should be grateful, and perhaps the world should be grateful for Australia, because as I understand it, we are early adopters of every new gadget that comes out and love to buy it and keep it happy. But, Edward, I think the key thing is your article is very interesting. It reminds us of this thing we take for granted that has come down so dramatically in price and now can be found, as I said, just about in every household. It has been, as you describe it, a cool century for the fridge or refrigerator, and it's now, having had a rough start, a pretty safe appliance that every house can enjoy. And I think when we go home tonight, we should take a frosted glass out of the refrigerator, fill it with something, and raise a glass. Happy birthday, happy 100th birthday to the refrigerator. Thanks, Edward.
Thank you very much.
Edward Tenner is a visiting researcher in the Rutgers Department of History and the Princeton Center for Arts and Cultural Policy Studies. And the book he mentioned is called Why Things Bite Back: Technology and the Revenge of Unintended Consequences. And it was published by Random House. And that's it for this week. Don't forget that if you'd like to hear any of today's interviews again, or if you'd like to leave a comment or make a suggestion, please do so. Just go to abc.net.au/rn and follow the prompts to Counterpoint. Thanks for your company today. I'm Amanda Vanstone, and until next week, arrivederci.
By 2040, heat waves and droughts were the norm. Control measures such as water and food rationing and Malthusian one-child policies were widely implemented. In poor nations, conditions were predictably worse.
Naomi Oreskes of Harvard on the collapse of Western civilization. Could this really be our prospect 25 years from now? Is it avoidable? Hear the collapse and how to avoid it by going to the RN website.